From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments last week in what's been described as the biggest case relating to abortion in a generation. The law in question is from the state of Mississippi and would ban abortions in the state 15 weeks after conception. But if the court upholds the law, the case is expected to have ramifications far beyond Mississippi. Because to uphold the law, the court could overturn or weaken the decision in the landmark Roe v. Wade case from 1973, which prohibited states from banning abortion before fetal viability, which is around 23 weeks. If the court decides that way, access to abortion would become quite difficult in more than half of the United States, especially in the Midwest and South. But here in Illinois, abortion is protected by both state law and Illinois Supreme Court precedent, so clinics are expecting to see an increase in patients traveling here from out of state. One of our guests today refers to these patients as medical refugees. Joining us now to talk about what changes to abortion access around America could mean for Illinois and how clinics are preparing is Katie Watson. She's a lawyer and associate professor of medical education, medical social sciences, and obstetrics and gynecology at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine. She's also the author of Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie, welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Roy.
Also with us from Granite City, Illinois, is Dr. Erin King. She's the executive director of the Hope Clinic for Women, which has provided medical and emotional care for women seeking abortions since the 1970s. Women come to the clinic from all over the country. Dr. King, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Diana Parker Kafka, executive director of the Midwest Access Coalition, an organization that provides money for travel and expenses to women going to or from the Midwest to seek an abortion. Diana, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Listeners, I want to say before we begin that this conversation is not a debate, obviously, on whether abortion should or should not be legal. We had one of those not long ago on the show, back when Texas passed that bounty law. Rather, today we're going to be hearing how people who do think it should be legal are preparing for what's next in Illinois. And given that, we want to hear from you. You can join the conversation at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Or you can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. So, Katie, I'm going to begin with you. You've studied the law of abortion in the United States. Can you talk about this case that was argued recently, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, which, again, has been described as the most significant Supreme Court case on abortion rights in almost 30 years?
Sure. I think the unspoken question of the Dobbs case is whether women are people under the Constitution. Historically speaking, we forget that women's legal personhood is a relatively recent invention, and Roe versus Wade was a central piece of jurisprudence as part of that. And so what's really at stake here is the question of whether state governments can commandeer a woman's body and force her to produce another person against her will. That's what's on the table here. And so the specifics of the Dobbs case, Mississippi, as you said, banned abortion at 15 weeks, after 15 weeks, rather than the viability standard that's been the standard for almost 50 years, that allowed, where states could ban if they wanted to. They weren't required to. So ordinarily, that would just be rubber stamped, clear violation of Roe versus Wade. In this case, because of the three new justices who were appointed by President Trump, the court granted certiorari, saying that, yes, we will hear this case. And they granted it on a very specific question, which was, are all pre-viability bans on abortion unconstitutional? Roe held they were. And we can talk later, if you like, about the viability standard and its significance. But the court granted cert on that question. Now, they don't grant cert on that unless they probably have five votes to say yes. And so in terms of expectations, most court watchers feel pretty sure they'll at least affirm the Mississippi standard and roll those weeks back. There's no principled basis for doing that as opposed to the viability standard. So I think that will harm the court's institutional legitimacy at minimum. However, the other important point is that the Mississippi Solicitor General, in their brief and argument, the true focus was on overturning Roe versus Wade. And Justice Roberts actually called him out on that and said, this is not the question we granted cert on, but there's a lot of energy in the, within among the justices to just flat out overturn Roe and return the question to the states. Justice Kavanaugh very clearly presenting his rationale for that. Justice Coney Barrett asserting what I think is a terribly insincere and inaccurate claim that, oh, things have changed because now we have safe haven laws. False. We had adoption during Roe, or before Roe, forever. But there's energy there to entirely overturn Roe and return the question to the states. And I'll say, so the second question in the case is, as Justice Sotomayor posed it, will the court ever recover from the stench, is the word she used, of the appearance that the reading and interpretation of the Constitution is a purely political act, because nothing has changed of significance since Roe that would merit overturning that precedent.
Sure.
Nothing scientifically, medically, historically, or socially, except for the progress that women have made since 1973 in independence and public participation and economic participation. That would be what the court's reacting to.
And the, obviously, as you pointed out, the change in composition on the court. So, okay, there's a lot you talked about there. I want to come back to some of those ideas, particularly this question on how you define viability and also the court's jurisprudence itself. But let me bring Dr. King into the conversation. Dr. Aaron King, your clinic is in Granite City, Illinois. For listeners who may not be familiar with the geography, that's pretty close to the Missouri border, about 10 minutes from St. Louis. Can you talk about the significance of that location geographically?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a physician, but also the executive director of the Hope Clinic for Women. And that is an independent provider of abortion. And what that means, actually most providers of abortion in the country are independent. And that just means that we aren't affiliated with Planned Parenthood. We are our own healthcare entity. We are about 10 minutes from downtown St. Louis, and we have seen firsthand here what happens when states essentially ban abortion. We are so close to Missouri, and in the last couple of years, about the last 5 years, but specifically in the last 2 years, there just aren't abortions happening in Missouri anymore, very few. And the reason that happened was because the laws in Missouri got so restrictive. And so we've been able to actually watch this play out right before our own eyes. In fact, a significant proportion of our patients are from states outside of Illinois because of our location close to the Missouri border, but there's also other states fairly close by that on and off over the last several years have been changing their laws around abortion. And those changes happen quickly and affect patients immediately in some cases. And I know you mentioned at the beginning of this talk, the word medical refugee, but it really does become a situation where, you know, when patients find out they are pregnant and they can't be pregnant at that time, they suddenly are thrown into this world of trying to find someone, a gynecologist or another healthcare provider, that can safely end that pregnancy for them. And they may not be keeping up on all the laws in their own state or in the states that surround them. And suddenly they are almost, like you're saying, like a refugee looking around, trying to find somewhere safe and competent and accessible to them. And that is confusing enough. So we've seen that firsthand with our patients right here on the Missouri border, and have been really unfortunately preparing for what is now happening in the Supreme Court. And I'm being pessimistic, but what I think is going to happen in almost half of the United States is that abortion will be restricted significantly in those states. And you will have patients from all those states. There's 21 states that already have either old laws or new laws that will ban abortion. And then five more states that will probably do the same thing. So we're talking 25 states where all of a sudden these patients will be looking around saying, wait, I'm pregnant. I can't be pregnant. Where do I go? And the places like Illinois and my office that happens to be right here on the border between Missouri and Illinois will again see these patients coming from probably all over the Midwest. And we've been preparing for that for, unfortunately, a couple years after we watched what happened to the patients in Missouri.
Diana Parker-Kafka, I want to ask you, you're the, as I mentioned earlier, the executive director of the Midwest Access Coalition. What does the coalition do? How does it assist people who are seeking abortions?
Yeah. So as Dr. King mentioned, over the past few years, a lot of abortion restrictions have gone on the books in states surrounding Illinois. And so MAC, Midwest Access Coalition, we call MAC, was founded to support people who needed to travel from those states to Illinois. More and more, the people that we have accompanied on their journeys are coming from out of state. About 70 to 75% of people that we support in the Midwest are not from Illinois. And I think the percentage is also the same for people who get care in Illinois. The people we support coming to Illinois are about 70% coming from outside of the state. And so over the years, we've developed a program that's been based on the needs of people who reach out and say they are in Indiana and they have an appointment at Hope Clinic, which is one of our close partners, Northwestern or Family Planning Associates or the Planned Parenthoods in Illinois, and say, you know, they're able to get this procedure scheduled, but they need help with childcare, they need help with gas money, or they don't have a car and they need to figure out a way to get there. They need help with medications, hotel accommodations. Sometimes there's last minute emergencies like car breakdowns or their ride falls through. And so we have a program of coordinators that are on our hotline every day to make sure that those barriers don't come between them and their abortion provider. And so they could complete their procedure and go back home and be with their communities and families.
So I think what I'm hearing from all of you, Illinois destination almost makes it sound a little too flippant, but it's a place where people feel they can come to get these services. Katie, let me ask you, what are restrictions on abortion in Illinois currently?
Well, Illinois has basically codified the Roe versus Wade standard in our Reproductive Health Act. And so if Roe were overturned tonight, for the people capable of pregnancy in Illinois would wake up tomorrow with this basically the same standard. So that's why we're considered something of a haven state, because we do protect the rights of people capable of pregnancy to decide if and when to have a child or another child. The state legislature recently repealed our Parental Notice of Abortion Act. And so starting, I believe, in June, minors will be counseled and encouraged to involve parents or trusted adults by the physicians that they work with in the same way they are if they come for prenatal care, which is kept confidential if they'd like it to be. And so we have very few restrictions. The restrictions we have are more focused on health and safety. Our legislature has also approved extending Medicaid for all reproductive events, whether that's contraception, birth, or abortion, regardless of reason. And I think that's a terrific policy for a funny reason. I mean, I think it's terrific for many reasons, but I want to offer this as an ethicist. For folks who are more concerned about the ethics or morality of later abortion, or abortion in the second trimester or third trimester versus the first trimester, the best policy initiative they could support is repealing the Hyde Amendment and providing Medicaid coverage for abortion as for all other health care. Because the barriers that Diana Parker-Kafka was referring to, some of these are financial. This need for people to pay cash out of pocket for this medical procedure it takes time to raise that money, particularly when you think about the fact that 49% of all abortion patients have incomes below the federal poverty level, which is a very low level, and another 26% are in that 100 to 200% range. Those are the people who are having to choose between risking eviction and not paying their rent and coming up with the money for an abortion, which takes time. So if you would prefer to see people seeking abortion to do it earlier, which most people want to do it as quickly as possible. They have no incentive to remain pregnant once they've made the decision not to, in supporting insurance coverage and states that ban even private insurance coverage. So if you looked at a map to Dr. King's description, you'd see we're sort of this donut hole of access surrounded by states that already have very limited access, and if they are permitted, are likely to prohibit all access or access except in the most early gestational ages.
Okay, we need to take a break. We're going to continue this conversation. One quick point of clarification, though, the repeal of the parental notice. The governor has said he will sign it. I don't think he's actually signed it yet. So technically not law yet, but he has said he will be proud to sign it. We're going to continue this conversation on what people who support abortion rights and providers are doing here in Illinois to brace for a potential overturning of the Roe versus Wade precedent. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the possibility, the real possibility, that the U.S. Supreme Court could be ruling on a case that came out of Mississippi, but the broader implications would be that the court would significantly weaken or overturn the Roe versus Wade precedent from the early 1970s that essentially prohibited bans on abortion before fetal viability around 23 weeks, although we can talk about that standard. The thought here is that the court is likely to, or at least it's quite possible that the court could significantly, as I said, weaken or overturn that standard, effectively allowing states to prohibit abortion access and potentially creating an influx of patients to Illinois, which is committed to keeping abortion legal, even if Roe versus Wade is overturned. That's in state law as well as Supreme Court precedent. We're talking with Katie Watson, who is on the faculty at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine and the author of Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. We're also speaking with Dr. Aaron King, who's executive director of the Hope Clinic for Women, which has provided medical and emotional care for women seeking abortions. It's located right in Illinois, but very close to St. Louis in the Missouri border. And we're also speaking with Diana Parker Kafka, executive director of the Midwest Access Coalition, or MAC, which provides money for travel and expenses to people who are going to or from the Midwest to seek an abortion. And if you want to join our conversation, the number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Katie, I want to ask, you wrote in your 2018 book that a lot of people maybe don't understand how common abortion is because the way it's often discussed privately and the way it's discussed as a political issue can be very different. And I don't know if you saw Cecily Strong, an actor on Saturday Night Live, Springfield-born Cecily Strong, actually, who did a sketch where she came out dressed as a clown, had, you know, spinning bow tie, balloon animal, red nose, and talked about the clown abortion she had when she was 23. And it didn't take long as you're watching this to realize that this is really a personal story. And she's not the only one who's shared it recently. Can you just talk about how common abortion is and this moment of more people coming forward to talk about their experiences with it?
Sure. Scholars call this the prevalence paradox. How can something that is so common be so stigmatized? And in my book is titled, the end of the title is Ordinary Abortion. And that's the term I developed when I realized that the cases we discuss the most are the ones that happen the least. And that's not to minimize them, But opponents of abortion access want to point to cases that they might think of as abortion abuse, cases that happen later in pregnancy. And supporters of access point to the most dramatic cases of rape or very young people or dramatic fetal anomalies. And those happen and they are real and important, but they're also a very small percentage. And I wanted to look at basically the 95% of cases that it seemed like nobody was talking about. And so the statistics are that 1 in 4 women, given the current rate of abortion, today is expected to have an abortion before she reaches menopause. The number earlier was higher. So of women over 45, you can estimate about 1 in 3 of them have had an abortion. And so how could something, my book was driven by this idea that, that we say we're so conflicted about abortion, but when the average American woman has 1.8 children, and in 1800, the average American white woman, and I apologize, that's the only group for whom statistics were collected, had 8 children. You know, how do they do that? It turns out we actually use contraception and abortion a lot in this country. So my book was about exploring that disjuncture between the frequency of need and use and the public conversation, which suggested we're so terribly divided. And also this is so, perhaps an unusual activity. And I noted that the public conversation has become so utterly toxic that that creates a stigma that inhibits private conversation in many communities, families, or relationships. So the incredible number of women who have abortions don't speak of it, even in private conversation where among friends or loved ones who would disclose lots of other personal or medical or family information. So I think that's contributes to the stigma. And it was wonderful to see Cecily Strong and others speaking about their abortions publicly, owning them, and introducing that, you know, someone, and there's a saying, you know, people say in this community, you know, someone you love has had an abortion. And I always want to put up parens, and it might be you, that you know people. And so the more people who speak up and say, you know me, you like me, guess what? I also had an abortion and I'm a moral agent. You know, I reasoned through this and I thought it was ethical or ethical enough for me to do. It was important. I needed it. And you and I may disagree on it, but we're allowed to do that because it's not just my body, it's my conscience and my family. And I get to control that and I own that. These are still public conversations. And in my book, what I support and celebrate those, but I really encourage private conversations. Sometimes it's harder to tell your uncle at Thanksgiving, the people you're describing, I am one of them, you know, and think of it as that sort of, it's not the same as, but we can draw an analogy to coming out privately. And sometimes it's easier to tell a room of strangers your story than your family who you're going to see the next weekend.
Mm, yeah. Dr. King, I wonder if there's a typical profile of a client coming into your clinic, or maybe, I don't know if there's some experiences, stories that have stuck with you, of course, without giving out identifying information over the years.
Sure. I can tell you our typical patient is anyone who can get pregnant. So imagine anyone that you know that can get pregnant, that is a typical patient for us to see. So people come to us from all across the country. They come to us at all different ages. We see all different races. We see all different income levels, but they are all people who can get pregnant and for their own particular reason cannot be pregnant at that time. So I'll give you an example. I saw a patient last week who lives a couple blocks away and called us up when she found out she was pregnant and was shocked that her Medicaid, because she lives in Illinois, covered her procedure and she didn't have to wait several weeks to save up money. In fact, she called asking, you know, how much do you guys charge? And we said, well, do you live in Illinois and do you have insurance coverage? And certainly she did. And her procedure was completely covered. And she had already talked to her partner and actually also her sister and had really felt like this was not the time for her to be pregnant. She was already a mother and came in and saw us and was greatly relieved that she was able to get this care so close to her community, her and the people she trusted. Her sister came with her. and also covered by her insurance without a copay or anything like that. I also saw a patient last week who drove about 250 miles from southern Missouri and didn't have that same coverage and had to wait about 3 weeks until she got paid and could arrange childcare for her one other child, and came with a trusted partner to drive to see us, but was very disappointed that, you know, she couldn't find anywhere closer to her to see her. Her doctor had actually referred her to us, which is pretty unusual from Missouri, but felt like they trusted us and had referred her. She had found out she was pregnant a little bit later than she expected, and also then, like I said, had to wait several weeks to arrange her life to come see us. And again, she also left relieved that she could find us, almost with that same level of relief, but she had had about, you know, I would say 4 or 5 more barriers to her care than the other patient I mentioned. And those are literally real stories from real patients I saw in the last couple of weeks. So we see really any reason you could imagine where someone doesn't think they can be pregnant at that time, from like what Katie was mentioning, the most unique kind of stories that you maybe hear in the media, to just your everyday reasons of money, issues within your family or with your partner, or, I mean, there's probably all sorts of things that probably a lot of us don't deal with day to day, reasons we can't be pregnant unless you're there in that patient's shoes. So, but really one of the most important things is our patients and centering their care and being able to help them remove as many barriers as we can if they need us. And that's what, for instance, Diana's organization is doing. We have a really close relationship with them to help patients with a lot of the logistics. I probably see a lot more patients in a day with that second story where they're traveling far with significant barriers in their way than, you know, the patient who's able to come from down the street and just have everything covered by insurance.
Well, Diana, what does that process look like for your organization? When somebody reaches out, needs help, or are you reaching out to people? How does mm-hmm. that actually work?
Yeah, so usually the client, as we call them clients, reach out to us because they were referred to by their clinic. Often Hope Clinic sees a lot of our clients, and they're reaching out because one, they likely don't have funding for their procedure covered yet. And so they're asking for help with the procedure cost coverage. And they are also looking for a way to get to that clinic. I would say you asked Dr. King what a typical patient looks like. Everybody who can get pregnant is a typical patient, but for people who are reaching out to us, they're usually parenting already. The vast majority of our clients are already parents, and they're making this decision that's because it's the best for them and their family and their communities. They're also people of color, because communities of color are facing a lot of systemic barriers, including healthcare access. And so they are often calling us saying they, you know, need to figure out childcare and need help coordinating that. They need a place to stay overnight because they're often traveling, driving many hours to get to Hope Clinic. We, since SB8, we have had people driving 12 hours from Houston to get to Illinois, to get to Kansas, getting that one-day procedure and needing to stay overnight. Some folks just turn around and drive the 12 hours back. But we provide hotel accommodations at hotels that the clinics recommend and trust. We are also reimbursing people for childcare, for meals, because meals are expensive when they have to travel and, you know, don't have grocery access. We are also just on the line to provide emotional support. And I would also like to point out that, you know, our clients sometimes are often anti-choice forced birth supporters, and we support them the same way we would support anybody, but they do let us know that they, you know, that they are anti-choice and they are getting this procedure, but they still have the right to abortion care, and we support that fully. So I would say like the vast majority of our clients just have a lot of barriers that they're facing just to get to their provider. And the most common barriers are childcare, because most of them are parents are paying for meals while they're away and finding a place to stay overnight where they can rest and be safe and comfortable.
Interesting. Well, we only have a few minutes left in our conversation. And one of the things that we did mention early is this question of viability. And the Guttmacher Institute, which is pro-abortion rights, in addition to that parental notice, which, again, is pending repeal, it's sitting on the governor's desk here in Illinois, it lists the only other restriction on abortion in Illinois. It says that it may be performed at or after viability, only if the patient's life or health is in danger. Dr. King, what is viability? How do you... Because I realize this is not a topic that's, you know, black and white, right?
Right. And I hate to defer to Katie because sure. just a little bit, because it's this. I know she has probably a very good answer to this. Not that I don't have an answer, but I think hers might
be maybe it's more a legal question than a medical question,
yeah, it is.
Which is okay. Well, then, Katie, how about it?
It's the interface between the two. The Roe court, I think, did a fabulous job. If you have to draw a line, and there's a great question of why would you have to draw a line after the Roe court concluded that an embryo or fetus is not a person under the 16 uses of the word person in the Constitution, why wouldn't the conclusion be that the pregnant person, who most certainly is a person protected by the Constitution, can't decide all along, right? That's to me the weakness of Roe and the unanswered question. But the court said we do want to draw a line where the state interest in potential life can supersede the pregnant person's interest, which is interesting. And they put it at viability. So what they said, think of the constitutional standard cruel and unusual punishment. Right? There's lots of standards that are verbal so that they can change with the times. And so what they said is viability is a reasonable possibility of a meaningful life outside the womb. And so viability is the only gestational or developmental standard that actually takes into account the person in whom the fetus lives. All other standards, whether they're based on fake science or real standards, look at a fetus or an embryo as if it's growing in an aquarium, right? But the viability standard said, to paraphrase, the biological goal of a pregnancy is to create an independent person, a baby that lives on its own outside, not connected to a person's body. At the point at which there's a reasonable probability that it could do that if it were delivered prematurely, we'll say that's the point where the state has an interest in that potential life, understanding, the Roe court said, that this will change as science and medicine evolve. In Roe, they pegged it, they said, it's not constitutional for states to pick a number in their statute. This is up to physicians. They said it happens today in 1973 at around 28 weeks, but sometimes as early as 24. And now medicine really does put it closer to 24. And that's when, and I would invite Dr. King in here with the most recent data, but if you delivered prematurely at 24 weeks, you would have around a 50% or better chance of survival to discharge from the NICU. And so people think viability means definitely could live. No, it's more in the 50-50 range. And then with a significant chance of mild, moderate, or potentially severe disability. And those numbers improve past 24 weeks, right?
Sure. Okay.
At 22 weeks, they're very bad. Nobody wants to deliver at 22 weeks or 23 weeks or 24 weeks with a wanted pregnancy. So that's where the court pegged it. And that's why 15 weeks, Mississippi did not even offer a fake science rationale. Yeah. They knew they had the Supreme Court in their pocket, and they just said abortion at 15 weeks is barbaric. And I would conclude by saying forced parenthood is barbaric.
I'm afraid we need to end the conversation there. Katie Watson, Aaron King, Diana Parker Kafka, thank you so much for being with us today for this important conversation here on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thanks.
More to come after a short break. Stay with us.